to Crown Heights?
We moved to, we moved here in this house in 1954, April of 1954.
And where were you born?
I was born in South Carolina, in a little place called Holly Hill, South Carolina.
When was that?
Oh dear.
The impolite question.
Oh, 1916.
And did you come straight to Crown Heights from South Carolina? Or?
No, we went to Harlem and I stayed in Harlem until I was in my late 20s, I think, and then I moved to the Bronx. And from the Bronx, moved here in 1954.
And why Crown Heights?
That's a good question. I tell you, I didn't know anything about Brooklyn until someone called me one morning and said that there was a house here that he had been looking for, his new bride. But he said, I can't quite swing it. He said, the neighborhood is beginning to change. He said, he happened to have been a black friend of mine, was a very fine musician. He said, the neighborhood's beginning to change, and I'd like to see a wonderful family move there. He said, I know that you have been married not too long, and we felt that maybe you were looking for a place to go. This would be a wonderful place. And he gave me the name of the agent. He showed him the house and said, why don't you go and look at this house? And it was amazing that he did that, because at the time I was living in a little house in the Bronx. I had four rooms, no closet space. The second baby was born, and I was just out of my mind for space. But we didn't have any money. Didn't have any money at that time. I didn't realize how expensive houses were. But we were out looking for houses, and everywhere we'd go, and they would quote these enormous prices. Oh my goodness, I said, I can't see getting out of here at all. And I was so burdened, one day I got on the bus and went up to Saratoga to visit a friend who had a guest house there. Because with the two babies, you know, I was just beside myself. Babies, no space to live in, no closet space. So I took the crib down from my sister's house, who lived in the same house as I. She had two rooms also. I said, you keep the babies for me while I go and get away for a few days, because otherwise you have to come up to Mattawan and visit me. I said, I will not be able to survive. So she kept these babies, and I went up to Saratoga. I took my Bible, and I took my religious books, and in the morning I would get up and go out to the college there and sit outside and read my Bibles and pray. And I remember one day, very early in the morning, that weekend, I'd gone to study, early in the morning the birds were just flitting from branch to branch, and the trees were filled with leaves. I said, Lord, there is a place for every leaf on that tree, and the birds are here. I said, there's got to be a house for me somewhere. And do you know, my husband came up to get me that Sunday to drive me back to the Bronx where I live. And Monday morning, before I got out of the bed, I got a telephone call. This gentleman said, Lavinia? This is Furman Fordham, my dear friend. He said, you know, I started to call this early. He said, but you know, I just had it on my mind. I saw a house and it's in Brooklyn. And I thought, if you were looking for a house, this is the place for you to go. And that's how I got this. When we walked over here and walked into this building and this house, and I saw these windows and these floors, I said, that's the place for us. And fortunately, my parents and my sister and my brother helped us out, and that's how we got on Carroll Street. And this house has been, I tell you, Mr. Wiley, this has been a blessing, not only to my family, but to other friends, you know, who, it's been a port in a storm. So that's a long story as to how we got here, but it's a precious one, and I love telling it because I know it was designed by God that we should be here, and the things that has happened to me and to others since we've been here just marvelous.
What organizations were here when you came? What institutions did you depend on? Were there any?
Well, as a black, I really didn't depend on any organizations at that time. Of course, the schools were here. My children went to PS 161. That was quite something, too, because, you know, that was the time when busing was such an issue. You know, the integrating of schools, and it was such an issue to bus children in and out of the neighborhoods, and it brought about quite a lot of conflict between the neighbors and between the parent organization, parent organizations in the various schools. I put my children in, and I always became active in the school system. So, I mean, as a parent. And so there were meetings galore about whether to permit busing children into the neighborhood. And certainly the people who lived in this neighborhood couldn't see busing their children out to other neighborhoods, you know? So it was quite a lot of conflict going on between the parent associations and the various schools. They were always very wonderful, I thought, to me, I guess, because I was a musician, and I was always willing to participate and become active in whatever they had in the school at the time. There was always the idea, I think, that as long as there are a few, you know, blacks, that was a reality, you know, it's painful to think about at times, but it's true. As long as there were a few blacks, it was all right. But then when a lot of us came, there became conflict.
How many black people were here when you came?
Well, let me
not
see.
Not a number, but...
Well, you mean, I don't know about the whole area, but I can tell it, maybe you can judge from the number that was on this block. When I moved in this block, there were, let me see, the Fierces and Walkers. Not the Blounts were here yet. Mrs. Neron is, and there was a minister here. There must have been about five on this block, five homeowners on this block when I moved here.
And most people who lived in this area owned their own home?
Yes. Okay. They all owned their own home, surely.
And how was it easy to purchase the house? Was there any resistance to?
Well, it was easy for me at that time, I guess. It wasn't difficult, and the houses were reasonably priced at the time. It wasn't difficult, but I'll tell you one thing. When the blacks began moving in, there was a quick exodus of people selling their houses and getting out.
Who did you buy from?
I bought from an agent, yes.
And the local Were they local?
Yes. He had his office right around there on Kingston Avenue. And they were very, very nice people, you know. No problem.
And so the people who didn't own their own homes wouldn't be in this area?
No, they would not be in this area. And they were very, very strict about who lived in the whole houses after you bought them. You know, in other words, I had a visitor one night who came down from that down the block, one of the homeowners, to let me know that this was a very restricted area, and these were one-family houses, and we were not to rent to anybody. There were to be no rumors. He just laid down the law to me. There to be no rental of rooms, and we have ways of finding out, you're very, very restricted. So the idea was that if you cannot afford to live here, live in these houses without having rumors or assistance or tenants, then you don't belong here. So they told me that was what it was, and I could expect a visit from the neighbors to see that this would be.
Was the assumption that black residents were more likely to need rumors?
Yes. Of course that was the assumption. And of course I must say, I have to say that when we moved here, it looked like that was going to be the case, because I didn't move in here with a Cadillac, you know, and a lot of material. Obviously, we were not wealthy. We didn't have a lot of material goods to come in, I hadn't thought about that, really. I knew I needed a house. I knew we had begun a family, and I was a musician. I was looking for a place for a home in a nice area where when the children were of school age, you'd be able to go to school, you know, and where I could continue to study, maybe to go back, continue my education. I could see it all, you know, without all of that burdensome problem of congestion that I'd left in the Bronx, you know, and no space and no time to do anything, no freedom of mind. I was just looking for a place where I could go and live like people. And when I walked in here, I saw the neighborhood, and I said, this is wonderful. I saw the house, so spacious, you know, and this would be wonderful. I did think at the time that I would like to have a music studio. And I didn't see any reason why I couldn't have a music studio. There were about 9 rooms, you know, with the basement area. I could see myself having a music studio, or even a friend coming to stay with us, you know. But now this gentleman came down that night to inform me that none of this could take place, you know, that we were restricted. And of course I was always feisty like my mother, you know. And I said, can you imagine I said, I was holding my baby in my arm at the time. I said, listen, we didn't move to Carroll Street for approval. I said, we are decent, law-abiding people who just want to grow and to get ahead. I said, and that's why we are here. I said, now, I don't need 9 rooms for my husband and me and this baby. I said, and if I find someone who I feel could grace my home, they will be here. So you could take that back to the organization. Well, you know, when I got finished talking with him and telling him about the things, my aspirations and what we wanted to, what I look forward to, he stood up and shook my hand and said, we're glad to have you. We are so glad to have you here.
Now, this is attached to something you said just a minute ago. You were a musician, or you are a musician,
yes.
And you were then. What type of work did you do? Describe the type of work you were doing when you came.
Well, I had been the organist of a church in Manhattan, actually, and I was teaching privately. I had private students. But of course, before the children came, I'd done some theater. And I was just singing and teaching and concertizing, you know. So when I came to Brooklyn, when the children were born, I had 2 children before I moved here. Noah was born shortly after I got here. But when the children were born, then of course I was no longer in the theater because I couldn't. I did not like the idea of leaving my children to go, you know, out on these trips out of town with the theater. I had many opportunities to do so. And as a singer, I knew Hall Johnson, you know, the dean of black writers and arrangers. I knew him quite well. And he had invited me to go with a group to Germany to do some concertizing there. My first baby was born at the time, and I turned it down because I said, no. The career has to go on hold, I said, because I need to raise my children. You know, I will not leave it to be kept and looked after by anybody but me. I want to do that. And so there were other opportunities where I could have gone out of town, even with Porgy and Bess, you know, they did a performance at that time. But I didn't go because of the children. I insisted on sacrificing the career, if that's what you want to call it, at the time for the children. So when I moved here, I was just depending upon the teaching and concertizing here and there, you know, occasionally, and playing for various churches. And of course, I had to do that because my husband was a postal worker. And as you can know, with a house this size and with just a postal salary, it was impossible for him to carry it alone. So I had to assist, you know. So I assisted then by taking every piano student I could get, every voice student I could get, and believe me, I had to get a lot of them in order to make a difference. And finally, my sister said to me, you know, Lavinia, you went to New York University and your subject was education. Why don't you see if you can get a job in the school system? And it was then that I went down and applied and was able to, you know, to be hired by the Board of Education as a teacher. And my first teaching job was in girls' high school. I was at girls' high school for 7 years, I believe, before it closed, you know, because that was also a casualty of the integration movement. They closed girls' high school and sent all the students and teachers to the various schools of the borough.
You said before that your family had helped you to get the house and everyone sort of pulled together.
Yes.
Where was the family at?
My mother was living in Harlem at the time, my mother and my father, and my sister and my brother were living in the Bronx. And they were, we've always been very close-knit family, and they were very supportive and very helpful. I knew that if I could get in here, that I would make it, because I was willing to do whatever necessary, but make whatever sacrifice. And then I had a talent. I could teach, and I could play for churches and for funerals. I played for many, many funerals. You know, anything to make ends meet, to pay the bills and make it for my children, my home.
When you were doing the private tutoring here at the house, where did the children come from? Were they from the area?
No, from the various churches. As I say, I always played for churches, and people will always recommend a good teacher, you know. And so a few of them were from the area. Yes, sir, because I had a couple of students whose parents lived down the block. But there weren't that many of us here at that time, you know.
So almost all black children?
Yes,
all black.
They were all black children.
Okay.
All black children.
And so your family was a big help to you when you got here?
To help, yeah, yes. Yes, I must say, okay. They were. They were, and they remain a help. Because as I say, we're a very close family.
Mm-hmm. When you looked around at that time, who else, were the other families here close-knit, or? I mean, were there sort of family ties here in the community for the other groups?
The other, yes, I would say so. Yes, I would say it's so, yes.
Do you think that that's still true today?
I think so. Yes, because we attended a Black Association meeting the other night, and it's, and, you know, it's so interesting to see the difference in the appearances of the people now than they were at the time, because we've all gotten that much older. You know, so say, I moved here in 1954, and they were all talking, and they have children who no longer live here. They moved away, they've gotten careers, and they are professionals, and they're all doing so very well. You know, it's just a joy to see us. And those of us who still, we can still get together and have our meetings and talk and enjoy each other. And at Christmas time, the members of the Black Association meet. Now we formed a group where we go to see a play at Christmas time, and then we have dinner. We come together as a Black Association and have dinner. And yes, we all brag and boast about our children and what they're doing, you know, and the success. It's wonderful. I would say it's been a marvelous experience to see how the members of the, how the homeowners on this block, and I would say it's the same with the other blocks around, you know, I don't know too much about the other. But if this block can be, you know, an example, they're doing very well. Very, very well.
When did the black community here, when you first came, when did they start to get their own social organizations or clubs or?
Well, I don't know when the Kingston Carroll Street Club was there. I can't pinpoint the date really, but it's been many years. Our children were, wait a minute, I can almost say, because Olive, my daughter, was about, Olive was about 5 or 6 years old, but a very, very friendly and very active little girl. And she knew everybody in the community before I did. And I remember going to a block association meeting, and this happened to have been at the home of one of our white neighbors at the time, one of Dr. Smith, I believe, Dr. Smith's home. We were discussing paving the alleyway out there, and I think one of our black neighbors was working with one of the city departments, and he had been chosen by the organization to do a lot of work in preparation for this big job of paving the alley back there. What's his name now? I think that was Mr. Morris. Yes, Mr. Morris held a very, very important position with the city, and he had been chosen to do a lot of work and do a lot of the planning for the paving of the area, of the alley. And as I walked into the meeting, I'm getting far away now, as I walked into the meeting that night, they introduced me, this is Mrs. Poynter from 1382, and nobody knew me, of course. I had been here, I had kept very quiet right in the house with the children, and then I was pregnant with Noah. This is Mrs. Poynter, and so they very politely said, no, Mrs. Poynter. And then someone said, that's Arthur's mother, and it was like a light just broke over, it just lit up the whole, Olive's mother, Olive. So I must say Olive was the one that got us introduced, really, to the neighbors here.
How much interaction was there between your children and other children and families?
A lot. It was marvelous, the relationship between the children at that time. And I would say with the others, it was with our other neighbors too. They were friendly, you know. They were polite, let's put it like that. But with the children, they were marvelous. Yes, my children, my children's best, well, they were only the two little boys, Noel and Billy, grew up. And all of the other little boys and little girls around here were white. And they were here in the house all the time. They're the little Larry Lefkowitz, Audrey Lefkowitz, no problem whatsoever. And Mr. Lefkowitz would, every December 26th, made a point of taking Noel out with Larry, because they had the same birthday, and was always the same, you know. And I would call Mrs. Lefkowitz and say to her, you can let Larry come over and play with the children, because Audrey was 7 years older than Larry, and Larry, a little boy, they had nothing in common. Audrey needed a little space of time away from Larry. But Larry found it very, very pleasurable to be with Billy and Noel. And I would say to Mrs. Lefkowitz, let Larry come over and spend some time. and she always did. And to this day, Larry is an archaeologist now, living in I think he's in Arizona. But anyhow, he's out of the state now. He never comes to town that he doesn't come by. He brought his wife here one day and said, and this is after he had gone to the army and was discharged from the army, had married and had a little girl. He came by and said, Mrs. Pointer, do you mind if I take Gwen, his wife, upstairs? He says, I just want to show her where I grew up and what my home was like when I was here as a little boy. And so sure enough, they did. I stayed downstairs, and he took Gwen up, and they walked all through the house. He's showing her, this is the bedroom, and this is what, and Billy and Noel and I were here, and we did this. They came out, walked all around. It was so touching. And you know, when Larry would come out of the army on leave, he'd come here. And Mrs. Lefkowitz, I remember calling, said, Mrs. Point, have you seen Larry? So I said, Larry, and Larry spent the night here with us. So I said, Larry, did you go home? He said, oh, I'm going. And I had to say, Mrs. Lefkowitz, I'll let you talk to Larry. But he would come here.
So the children all sort of got along fine, and the girls and the...
Absolutely.
And how about as the Lubavitch, because that's really the Jewish population that's reformed and conservative that you were talking about.
Yeah.
How about the Lubavitch population as they
increased? They were not here. But as they began to increase, but by that time, my children were a little older then, you know, and getting to be teenagers. But they were very isolated. They stayed to themselves, more or less, you know. But there was no conflict. They just had their own little community and stayed together. Now, there may be others who had different experiences. But my experience has been, you know, positive. They have their culture, their way of living, their own habits, their own friends, and they stayed there. But no conflict. There was no fighting or anything like that. Mm-hmm.
So when you first came, where did you attend church? Not here.
Well, as I say, I was an organist of the church. Mm-hmm. And at the time, in the beginning, I kept my position as organist, and I'd go back to Harlem to play and to worship, you know. But after time, I joined the church here in Brooklyn. And I went for a while, for a number of years. From the time Noel was 4 months old, we were attending the Christian Science Church on New York and Dean. We attended there, and a long time before I took out membership there in the Christian Science Church on New York and Dean. And we stayed in Christian Science Church for about 10 years.
And how active were you in Crown Heights, in this community, when you first came?
Well, as I say that, so far as the organizations were concerned, the only thing I was active in were the school. I was active in school.
What big events do you remember? That's a vague phrase, but what big things do you remember about the last year? It's almost 40 years now.
Mm-hmm. anyway, that had, that has to do with this community in particular. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, it has nothing to, I don't know if it has nothing to do with school. Everything that has to do, because my whole activities were locked around, was involvement in the school system, mm-hmm. and everything in the school system was big for me. And being a musician, all of the church events that took place, I was a part of in various churches, because I'd always play for them, or perform for them, or direct choirs for them.
How has this area changed since you got here?
Well, there were many, many children, of course, and a lot of children participating in games in the streets. Now, it's not quite that way. But our children used to play in the street. And at a certain time, they'd come in, we could call them in the house. But now, I don't find, I guess what happens in Carroll Street is happening all over the world, or for that matter. There is a bit in involvement with the children that we used to have, because we don't, I guess you don't feel that you can quite communicate to the children you see walking up and down the street you know, that you used to. I guess, you know, I'm just getting so much older, it seems that maybe I can't get the, I can relate to the children, I take that back, because I hear the children out there playing, but there seems to be a difference somehow. There seems to be a difference somehow in the way the children communicate and play with each other in the street than it was when our children were out there. Our children seem to be children. I don't know if I'm explaining that very well, but when we moved here and our children were out there playing, they just seemed to be children. Now the children seem to be so adult. You know, even the young, even the little ones seem to be so adult.
Is that because of some social change or the pressures that are on them? Or?
Maybe it is. Maybe it's the pressure.
But to you, it's very real. It's
to me, that is so. The children are not children the way they used to be. Well, you know, you can see that in the school system also. They're not children. And it's not their fault, it seems, I don't know. They're forced to grow up, and they're forced to be so guarded, you know. The children are forced to be so guarded the way, but they can't be free to be children anymore, it seems. No, it's a pity.
Let me ask, on a lighter topic, what do you like best about Crown Heights?
Well, having lived in Harlem and lived in the Bronx, it has an openness to it. It seems to me I like the space. I like the spaciousness of the place, especially the, you know, where we're living here. I don't feel put upon. I don't feel cramped in. I don't feel hemmed in at all, you know. I just feel free, you know. And I find that my neighbors are all friendly. You know, I don't feel restricted. I don't feel that I have to be on. Now, some neighbors may say we have a different attitude about it, but I don't feel that I have to be on guard every minute. And obviously, some people don't feel like that because we had at our block association meeting the other night, a policeman came to talk to the group, and the parents, the people were giving their expressing their concerns about the neighborhood, and many of the concerns, I just stood and looked and turned my head, and I wasn't so aware of all of the things that they say, but people are afraid of the robberies and the alleys and the lights and the fact that feel that that the blacks in the community won't get the protection that the whites get, you know. And maybe this is a reality, but it just hasn't struck me, so maybe it is a reality. But it hasn't caused me that much concern.
What do you like least about this area, if anything?
I love the area. I can't say that I like any more than any other place, you know. It wouldn't be about this area, you know. What I like least is not necessarily this area. How shall I put this? The concern maybe the selfishness, I think, maybe of people generally, you know. It's the attitude of what's in it for me, you know. I think, and that certainly is not just this area, but the idea of what's in it for me. If it's not for me, I don't want to have anything to do with it, you know. But and that always concerns me, because I think sometimes we have to look beyond ourselves and our own personal gains, you know, and what concerns me to the bigger good. And that sounds very whatever to some people, but that's actually the way I feel. I really feel that people have got to get to the point where they look at what's good for the general good, and not just for self, you know.
What do you think would make Crown Heights better? What changes would you like to see, if any?
I'd like to see, you know, I don't know, maybe this is asking too much, but I'd like to see more happen, like what happened at our program the other day. I'd like to see the Jews and the Hasidics and all of us get together and just have a nice time as we did at the program. You know, share the things that that all of us have in common. And we can see that we all have the same thing. We all want the same thing. We all love our children. We all want to educate our children. We would all like to have the freedom just to live and to be ourselves, you know? And that was such a beautiful thing. You don't know what it meant to me to be able to throw my arms around that little Hasidic mother-to-be, you know, the other day. And genuinely, she, you know, expressed the feeling of love and concern and care for her. I felt deeply, so deeply toward her, because we had so much in common, and yet we let our religion and our religious beliefs keep us apart. And that's not what religion is supposed to be. It's supposed to bring us together, you know? But because my religion says this, and my religion says that, we can't get together and let down and hug each other and show that that there's only one thing important. Oh, thank you. Thank you, Sister Ruth. There's only one thing important, and that is people should get together and love each other. You know? And I would love to see the day when those barriers could be broken down, where people could. And you know something? It could be. It could be, even with the Hasidics and the Reformed Jews and the Christian Jews, it could be. It could be broken down.
What would you like people to know about Crown Heights? People are often told about Crown Heights, mm-hmm. and they read about Crown Heights in papers mm-hmm. and all that, but what would you like them to know?
I would like them to know that there are wonderful people in Crown Heights, that we have the same aspirations, desires, we have homes, and some of the homes are lovely, and we're not all standing in a corner ready to hit them in the head and rob them, you know, as they go down the streets. I think Crown Heights is not a community of all lawless people. We have so many wonderful, law-abiding, beautiful people whose desire is only to make a better world, to make a better city, to make a better, make better homes for our children. Crown Heights is filled with those, with that kind of neighborhood. And the Jews are marvelous. I admire seeing them go down the street holding the hands of their little children. I think that's a beautiful sight. And sometimes I just wish that as a black community we would do more of that, you know? That's a beautiful thing to admire. And I think that what we ought to do in Crown Heights, as in all of the other communities, look at the beauty in the various races and emulate that, you know? And see what it is that's beautiful there. And try to take that as an example, you know? You know, I would like to see us as a black community stick together more, get more unified in the things that we want. And we And we can do that without, you know, negating anything else that another race does. You know, doesn't have either. To get together in unity and peace and harmony and one and in one accord with my neighbor and with my black neighbor doesn't mean that I have to negate everything else that goes on in the other. You know, I can love them and be unified with my blacks also. But somehow many people feel that in order to do that, I've got to, put down another group. You know, that's not necessary.
We talk about the tensions in Crown Heights. I'm saying we, but they're always talked about.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the cause of those divisions are? Do you have any idea of what causes those divisions?
In Crown Heights more than any other place?
Well, just here, taking mm-hmm. this as the example. It's not the only place mm-hmm. with divisions.
Mm-hmm. What causes division? A lack of understanding. We don't know each other. You know, you could never get me to say anything negative or unkind about Arna Lipkin. This is a city Jewish girl. You could never, because I know. You know, I know her concerns. And I know the love that she has, not only for her family, but the desire that she has to get along with me. And I also know why it's difficult for her, you know? And I think that if we try to understand each other, the tension would have of necessity be broken, you know?
Are the tensions that are here being aggravated? Are they being made worse by anything? For instance, the news coverage of it, does that make it worse? Or?
That's probably the worst. That would be the greatest reason for tension. I would say that would be
Do you see any way to, this is a difficult question, but do you see any way to solve these problems? If you had your druthers, how would you go about solving them?
Well, let me say, I would say this. Those of us who claim to be Christians, if we would study the Christian religion and study what it means to be a Christian, that of course, that would do it for us. And I suppose they could say the same for the others, for those of the other religions, but being a Christian, I have to talk from the standpoint of a Christian. If I followed the teachings of my Christian religion and my Christian background, I could not hate. There would not be tension. There would be understanding and there would be tolerance. I mean, if I really, really follow the teachings of my leader, which is Christian Jesus Christ, it couldn't be, because that's not what he was all about, you know. But now, if I'm going to use my religion as just as a traditional, you know, just to go to church and to go through the form and the fashion of having church and making it a ritualistic thing, Sunday after Sunday or day after day, whatever, and not go to the root of that Christian belief, these things can come up, and they will always come up. But I firmly believe what the Bible says, you know. Jesus Christ is love. And without that love, you cannot have peace and harmony. There'll always be conflict, you know. And why? Why should it be? This is a big, big world. You know, I look at the news and I look at the fight, and you know why the fighting is? All of that fighting, all over the world, I believe, is because people don't believe. People don't trust. People don't trust. People are fear. Fear has done it for us. Fear that if you get, I will be denied. And that is not true. This is a big word. We drive south, and we have family in the south. And you know, Dr. Wilder, you just go for miles and miles. All of this open space. All of this beautiful area. You know? There's plenty, and that's just going south. Go out west, you'll find the same. Go overseas, you go to other countries, you'll find the same. This is a big world, and there is room for everybody. And it's limitless. The wealth is enormous all over this world. But somehow, people are into the feeling that if I allow you to get, that will take away from me. And I never feel that.
Are you hopeful that the tensions here are going to be solved?
You have to always hope. Yes, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful. But I'll tell you, I don't think it will be solved unless people speak out and speak the way, you know, you and I are speaking now. You know, you just, because they're not going to, the problems will not go away. People have to talk about it, and people have to be willing to be criticized when you talk about it, you know. But you have to talk about it, and you have to understand, and you have to continue to love. You have to continue to love. And you have to talk about it, you know. I'm just hopeful. I went to Cuba last year, I think I told you, 91. And the beauty of the people there, they, you know, the sadness. You see the deprivation there. And it's so sad. But the beauty of the people, you know, it just gives you. I was there 5 days, and when I came back, it was just wrenched my heart to come back. I felt, and I didn't speak the language, you know, only through interpreter, and those few people who, you know, how to speak. But the love, and it's all over the world. My last night that my son taught, to preach there. We stood on the receiving line before we left the church, and a young woman, seemed to be about 30 years old, came to me. She didn't speak English, but through an interpreter, she came, she shook my hand, and she said something to me, and then she took off her earrings, and gave them to me. And Trevor said, she said, she has nothing to give you, but she loves you. And she took these little earrings off and gave them to me. Isn't that beautiful? And that was in Cuba. That wasn't in Crown Heights, Brooklyn. All the way over there to Cuba. And they had nothing. They didn't have very often not running water, very little food, even in the hotel where we lived. They didn't have toilet seats, you know. When the light bulb blew, that was it. There were no bulbs. So when we went over, we had heard about these things, we took light bulbs and we took toilet paper and we took, you know, aspirin, we took various things that we thought that they would like. But these people, and they've gone through all of this deprivation for so long, and yet there was this love that we're talking about. So strong and so beautiful, and that's what it's going to take to relieve the tension here. You know? That's what it's going to take. It's going to take love.
Thank you.
Yes.